widely available public information or things that are contained in this document, which is called the Joint Disclosure Statement. So this document is a bankruptcy court-approved document. It is the first and final word on the various possible plans of reorganization that are in front of the court. And in addition to the MRC Marathon plan, there's several other competing plans in front of the bankruptcy court, and we're going to do our best to describe elements of the MRC Marathon plan to people today, answer questions, but everything that we say is qualified and superseded by what's in this document. If you're a creditor of Pacific Lumber Company or Scotia Pacific, we strongly encourage you to read this document in its entirety, because this is what governs the options that you have in front of you. You're all here, I presume, because you saw us put an ad in the newspaper. The ad strongly encourages people to read the disclosure statement. It also tries to tell every creditor that your vote in the bankruptcy, even if your claim is small, matters. The unsecured creditors of Calco, of Pacific Lumber Company, and Scotia Pacific vote as a class in the bankruptcy, and how the class votes matters to how the bankruptcy process will be resolved. It matters to the judge, and so we encourage anybody who's a creditor to make sure that they vote. Although it may be a little bit awkward, some of the questions that may come up may cause us to refer specifically to things in the joint disclosure statement so we can be sure we're answering them as accurately as possible. If we're successful reorganizing the company and we ultimately are moving ahead, future conversations will not require us to hold up the document and read from a particular page to answer a question. Okay, now a few of the logistics.
May I ask one question?
Yes.
How do we vote?
That's the perfect question, because that was what I was going to talk about next. If you are a creditor of Pacific Lumber Company or Scotia Pacific, I believe you should have some kind of acknowledgement of a claim from the company. If you have a claim with Scotia Pacific or Pacific Lumber Company, you should have received a ballot in the mail that would allow you to vote in the bankruptcy process. If you did not receive a ballot, you can call Logan & Company. They're the administrator for all the balloting. And I'm going to give a phone number. So anybody who would need either a ballot, would need a copy of the disclosure statement, or anybody who's voted and wants to change their vote, all those things can be accomplished by calling Logan & Company. And the telephone number for Logan & Company is 800-224-7654. They also have a website, which is www.loganandco.com. In addition to Logan & Company, if people want to get a copy of the disclosure statement, there are some available outside this room. You can also go to the MRC website and get a copy of this as well. It's mrc.com. There's a button at the top that says MRC offers support to reorganize Calco. If you click on that, it'll take you to a court filing section, and you can find the entire disclosure statement there. As long as we're talking about voting, I was reminded by an attorney for MRC that if people, for creditors who are voting, they should be sure that they fill out their ballot completely. If you're a creditor of Calco, Scotia Pacific, and you want to vote and you're not sure how to fill out your ballot, you can call Logan & Company, or you can call any of the lawyers who are on the front page of the disclosure statement, front page and inside cover. Lots of lawyers. Okay. That covers housekeeping. So I'm going to turn to slides. I don't know how to bring this. we're here to both talk about the MRC Marathon Plan, answer questions for creditors, and answer questions for the public. I wanted to introduce some key members of our management team, but most of them are sitting in a, maybe they're on a plane right now. They think they have a fog problem. But we have, we'll do it in a second, I guess. We're going to talk about Mendocino Redwood Company, your neighboring company to the south, what we've done there over 9 years. Talk a little bit about the elements of the plan of reorganization that we have in front of the court. We'll show a chart that compares the MRC plan to other plans that's taken right from the joint disclosure statement, and then we'll have talk about questions and comments. So again, my name is Sandy Dean. My title is chairman. That's a lofty title. We're not a very formal company. Day-to-day, I was involved in the day-to-day operation of Mendocino Redwood Company when it was formed 10 years ago and did that for about 2 years. Then they got somebody who was more qualified for the job, and I took over really overseeing what happens at the business on behalf of the ownership, which is the Fisher family out of San Francisco. I work for them on this and other investments, and we are a family-owned business. We think as a family-owned business, we've had the ability to look out more than just quarter to quarter or even year to year to really take a long-term approach to managing the forest and the business. Particularly important, we think, in managing a forest, to be able to look out more than just a year or two for obvious reasons. We have a fellow from Marathon will be here before long, Gary Lumbo, Richard Higginbottom, who replaced me running our timber business day to day. Mike Janai is over here. Mike joined us, I think, 8 years ago. 9 years ago. Mike had worked at Big Creek down in Santa Cruz. It had 25 years of experience in the redwood business. When we formed MRC, we knew we wanted to take a different approach than a traditional industrial approach. Mike is one of the only people we could find in the redwood business who had for a long period of time been involved in something other than a traditional industrial approach, who had the right qualifications to come help us change the way the MRC lands are managed. And Marty Olheiser will be joining us also. Marty's been with us since the beginning and is involved in overseeing the distribution of our products. This is a slide our lawyers ask us to put in. I'm just going to repeat it one more time, and then again at the end. All the information that's in this presentation is available publicly. I think this presentation is being posted on our website this morning, so if you see something here that you wanted to go back and look at, you could go to the website and find it. Everything that we talk about today is qualified by what's contained in the joint disclosure statement, and we urge everyone, particularly creditors of Palco Pacific Lumber Company and Scotia Pacific, to read the bankruptcy court approved disclosure statement in its entirety before they make a decision about how they want to vote for the plans that are in front of the court. Okay. This is, we just thought we would start with a map of the whole redwood region. And let's see, you know, the Palco's lands are in kind of the brown up towards the top, green diamonds above that in the gray. Mendocino Redwood Company's lands are in the dark green, and Hawthorne is the tan between there. A Barnum, I think, would be above. I'll just go up here and point. I think this must be Barnum up here. Barnum's here, I guess. So, you know, this map, for me, has a message that the redwood business has evolved to have a couple of large landowners and a decent number of small landowners. Of course, people know over time the number of sawmills operating has really consolidated. That's on this map. Just where we're starting. Our business began in June of 1998. We bought the Mendocino County-based assets out of Louisiana Pacific. So that was 230,000 acres of timberland, two sawmills, one in Ukiah, one in Fort Bragg, a distribution business, and some related operations. When we started a business, we put up a purpose. We stated a purpose publicly. Demonstrate that it's possible to manage productive forest lands with a high standard of environmental stewardship and also operate as a successful business. So
Operating as a successful business, there's a lot of models what that means. Pretty easy. Pay your bills, hopefully make a profit, treat your employees well, be a good member of the community, do a good job for your customers. What it meant to be to operate with a high standard of environmental stewardship, there were fewer models for. The literal interpretation of that for us was leave it better than we found it. And that has come to mean, I think as we came to understand our lands better, some focus on restoration of the forest. We can talk more about that. But from the beginning, we started changing how Louisiana Pacific had been a traditional industrial operator of the lands. We started changing things from the beginning. We eliminated traditional clear cutting. We implemented an old growth policy down to the level of an individual tree. We lowered the level of the harvest to allow the conifer inventory to rebuild over time. We sought and ultimately attained a Forest Stewardship Council certification of our practices. And I covered that. There's a whole presentation on our website that probably has 25 slides with notes and pictures that talks about what have we done, what has that evolved to over the 9+ years we've been in business. Forests are, managing a forest is a very long-term proposition. So although we've been doing this for 10 years, we know in the life of the forest that's a very short amount of time. But as we approach our 10-year anniversary, there are some specific measurable ecological progress that we can talk about. The first thing is that there's a lot more trees standing in the MRC forest, a lot more volume of trees. And to be specific about that, In the time that we've owned our timberlands, we've added roughly 600 million board feet of additional standing inventory in the woods, redwood and Douglas fir. Second thing is that our lands in particular had, by virtue of the way they've been managed, had a lot of acres that at one point had been redwood and Douglas fir acres, but because of how they had been managed, had really come to be dominated by tan oak. And so we've treated 40,000 of those acres in a manner where we're reducing the level of the tan oak and setting the forest back up to have a robust, healthy, well-stocked conifer forest over the next 30 to 40 years in many of our lifetimes. Third thing that we like to talk about, although perhaps not the most sexy thing, we've invested $11 million in sediment and erosion control over the time we've owned our lands, and that has resulted in us withholding 700,000 cubic yards of sediment, of dirt, from the coastal streams that run through our property. And we have more to do on this, but we think that this is a pretty significant improvement to the fish habitat that we have on our property. And fourth, and I think, you know, in many ways as important as the other three combined, we really tried to change how our business related to the community. So we're a very open business. We have a lot of information on our website about the specifics of our forest. We're happy to take people any place, basically any time in the woods. We think of ourselves as a member of the community. We try to make decisions in a way that reflects the fact that we expect to be in the community for a long time. We can talk more about MRC and answer questions. MRC is relevant to people in this room mostly in the sense that when we talk about our plan for Palco, a lot of what we're going to do at Palco is going to look like what we did at MRC. And it's to some extent a picture of what the future could hold for Palco. So we're happy to talk more about that, but we'll wait and see if you guys want to or not. Here's a map of MRC's lands and Palco's lands. That's a lot easier to read than the first map. This is straight out of the disclosure statement. Just a little comparison of the two businesses. We were actually quite surprised when we started to make this table how similar the two are. So roughly the same amount of acres. That says 218. I think it's missing some acres in Sonoma County. I think we're really about 230, but it's close enough. Now, both have a lot of roads running through the property. They have almost exactly the same amount of streams. I think that's in miles of streams. Standing inventory. So the Palco lands even, you know, notwithstanding what we read in the paper and so on, the Falco lands have a lot of timber left on them, almost 4 billion board feet of conifer inventory. So they're still very well-stocked conifer timberlands. Perhaps they could be better in some places, but they have a lot of inventory, meaningfully more than what we have at Mendocino Redwood Company. Next line talks about how much of that inventory is not restricted in some way, because it's in a stream zone, because it might be in a preserve, because it's off limits for some other regulatory reason on a long-term basis. So 1.5 billion board feet of inventory at MRC, 2.6 billion board feet at Falco. Average harvest over the last 5 years, pretty big difference here. So at MRC, we're harvesting a very modest amount of our total growth, 33 million feet of harvest in the last 5 years, compared to at Falco in the last 5 years, an average of 126 million. The average is a little bit funny for Falco because it's really made up of several years of 160 million foot harvest, and then in 2007, I think it was 2006, it was 100 million feet, and 2007, I think, came in less than that. Average expected harvest in the next 5 years. So this is an MRC estimate for the estimate for us, 38 million feet. We feel pretty confident in that. 55 million feet at Falco. Big difference to the last 5 years. That's something that we talk about in the disclosure statement, how we've come up with that. We have looked to set the level of the harvest here in a manner where we have confidence it can be sustained on a long-term basis and ultimately begin to increase again. This is something that is really important to the future of the company. It affects how the forest will evolve. It also affects the value of the company. We've tried to set this in a way that we think would be good for the forest and sustainable and something that we can be confident in. Three more lines here. Average annual all forestry costs. So this is basically all the foresters, the biologists, the property taxes, and Falco spends meaningfully more than MRC, and I think that's a function of higher volume and also the requirements of the habitat conservation plan that Falco has. Average annual road expenditures, I was just talking to one of the guys over here about this. We spend $3 million a year on roads, give or take. Falco spends more than double than that. And we think, again, that's in part attributable to the habitat conservation plan and also abatement orders that have come from the water board over time. Forest related employees, 60 versus 83, that again, HCP related and volume related. Next slide just compares a little bit of the sawmill. So Falco has a sawmill in Scotia, the Scotia Mill, you guys all well aware of that. We operate a sawmill in Ukiah. Our sawmill was a smaller sawmill. It produces 55 million board feet a year of lumber. That's in the disclosure statement. When I talk to other people in the timber business, most people look at our sawmill and think, you know, it's an okay mill, but it's pretty small. It was built by Louisiana Pacific. It had a lot of trouble when it got going. It does a decent job today. The Falco mill is a much higher volume mill. It has the capacity to do much more volume than the Ukiah mill. The conversion cost is a measure of efficiency. What does it cost to convert 1,000 board feet of lumber? And the Ukiah mill does this for $115. There's more that could be talked about there, but our best view of what's happened to Falco is that their number is considerably higher. That's been moving around probably, but this is the best number we have. It's in the disclosure statement. We have a fence line, so we convert redwood boards into redwood fencing. Falco does the same thing. Our fence line's been running for a couple years and is now running pretty smoothly. The Falco fence line has been moved from one plant to another, and I think, you know, it's suffering a little bit from startup. But you know, we think there's room for improvement there, and that's what was being conveyed in this chart. Average log length and mill time. I don't think it'll say too much actually. So a little bit of comparison, we've talked about a little bit of comparison between the lands and the sawmill. Talk about our plan. The broad outline of our plan is to totally recombine the lands and the Scotia sawmill into a single entity and run them as an integrated forest products company. Yet everybody working towards the same objective, which is to make the combination of the land and the mill do the best they can financially over time. Of course, Pelco has lots of other things besides the land and the sawmill. It's got the town, it's got some other real estate, it's got the cogen plant. The town, the other real estate, and the cogen plant would be retained by Marathon. So I guess I should back up. Our plan is a joint plan. It's being proposed by us and Marathon. Marathon is a New York investment fund that lent a significant amount of money to Pelco in the summer of 2006. They approached us late in 2007 and asked us if we would work with them on a plan of reorganization, an effort to try and reorganize the sawmill and the lands into a business that could be a single business going forward. We agreed to do that, but felt like that what we would be good at is working on the land and the sawmill, and that they would need to figure out how to work with the town, the cogen plant, and the other real estate. Our plan has MRC, or an affiliate, putting up $200 million of new money to try and Marathon putting up $25 million of new money in cash. That would all go towards bringing the company out of bankruptcy. Marathon is owed $135 million of other money that they would convert into equity as part of the plan. So they would be taking a big piece of their loan that they made, thinking that they would be getting it back as a loan, and converting it into the assets that are left in Pelco. We would bring the MRC management team, which includes folks who work in our sawmill and so on, to be a part of this new business and to lead the business. We have identified what we think are roughly $10 million a year of benefits that could be had by combining the efforts of MRC and its sawmill operations and distribution business with the sawmill and forest operations of Pelco. And we would bring those savings to the new company, what's called NewCo in our plan. It's probably going to get a different name, but that's what it's called in the plan. We would bring our forest practices to the Pelco land, so the things that have worked well for us at MRC, eliminating traditional clear cutting, lower rate of harvest, adopting an old growth policy, working on erosion and sediment control, operating in a more open and transparent fashion with the community than what our predecessor had done. All those things we would bring to the Pelco Timberlands, and we would also immediately seek Forest Stewardship Council certification of the Timberlands as well. We would assume all the environmental obligations that exist on the Pelco lands, in particular the Habitat Conservation Plan that was agreed to as part of the Headwaters deal in 1999. The debt on the company would be reduced from $900 million or $1 billion down to $325 million. So when we're done, the debt on the company on day one would be $325 million. That would be debt that would be owed to the existing bondholders who are owed a lot of money against the timberlands. Trade creditors. So this is unsecured creditors. To the extent we have people in the room who are creditors of Pelco and Scotia Pacific, our plan has $10.6 million of cash that would be made available to the unsecured creditors when this comes out of bankruptcy. And our estimate is that the unsecured creditors would recover 75 to 90% of what they're owed. This probably is worth taking a minute to talk about. The disclosure statement estimates that the unsecured creditors, this is mostly people who have done business with Pelco or Scopac in some way. It includes people who may have been an employee and are owed money by the company. It includes people who provided services. The disclosure statement, based on information that was provided to the court by Pelco and Scotia Pacific, estimates that the unsecured claims of the company are $10.6 million today. However, that estimate does not account for outstanding litigation where Pelco or Scotia Pacific may owe money, and it does not include any liabilities that will come from contracts that might be broken as a result of the bankruptcy process. I am not aware that there's a reliable estimate of what those two things can be. Those things will add to the unsecured claims of the company. Our plan provides $10.6 million to pay the identified unsecured claims plus the claims that may come from contracts or claims that may come from litigation. And thus, there's an estimate that's been made that unsecured creditors would recover 75 to 90% of their claim because there's an assumption that the existing $10.6 million of known claims could in effect grow beyond the $10.6 million that's there to pay, and so people would recover most but not all of what they're owed. The note holders, they're often called the note holders or the bond holders in the press, are folks who are owed $800 million against the existing Palco Timberlands. And the MRC Marathon plan gives those note holders $175 million in cash and gives them $325 million in new notes. And they've indicated to us that they think that's inadequate. The new company that we are forming would assume responsibility for the existing Palco pension plan. So that's something that we would take on and make an obligation of the new business. The town would be reorganized. Marathon, our partner in this, would own the town. Marathon has a desire to work to get the town subdivided and to offer people who live in the town the opportunity to buy their houses. The rate at which that happens will depend on a number of things, including how fast can the regulatory processes be worked through that are required to divide the town up and make each house its own individual parcel. Bank of America owes some money here, and they'd be paid off. And all allowed administrative priority claims of the debtors be paid off. That's things like taxes in particular, than maybe other things. So these 12 elements of our plan are straight from the disclosure statement. There's a lot of information here. We can talk about that when we get through this. What's our business strategy for the new company? So first, we already talked about this. Integrate the timberlands and mill to maximize their value over time. Second, everybody knows the Scotia sawmill has had challenges. We think that the mill can be successful for the long term, and in our plan, its success is really a critical element of what we're trying to do here. So our plan provides that we would invest up to $7.5 million of new capital in the mill. That's a number that we arrived at by looking at what are the things that we think need to be done to the physical plant of the mill to allow it to be positioned for success for the long term. And the specifics of that are talked about in the disclosure statement. It includes, in particular, improving the front end of the mill to have more flexibility for the logs that can come into the mill. It improves speeding up the head rig. And there's some other equipment changes proposed. We detail that in the disclosure statement. Second thing is, we know that we think that the problems with the mill are more than just the physical equipment. We think that the approach of the mill needs to be changed. And so we want to match the production of the mill to the logs that are coming out of the woods. That includes both size and the rate of flow of logs into the mill. We want to change the strategy of the mill from one that has been seeking to make lumber for the lowest cost, which we understand that strategy and understand how the company arrived at that strategy, but we really think the long-term success of the mill depends on orienting the mill to make the lumber products that the market wants to buy. And we think we can do much better by getting a better price for the products that we sell than by trying to get the last nickel of cost out of the mill. By the way, this is the same strategy that we use to run our Ukiah mill. So we've developed this with the benefit of what we feel is the success that we've had in our existing business. We want to work to rebuild customer relationships that have been frayed over time. We know that the mill has had a lot of challenges, and as the mill works to try and meet all the goals that have been set forth for it, that it's our opinion that customer service has definitely been compromised. We think that can be improved. And finally, and on this slide, probably in many ways one of the most important things, we want to marry to the sawmill a capability to distribute the lumber rather than just selling what comes out of the sawmill as the mill produces it. We want to essentially build a distribution business around the mill. We came up with this idea because in our existing business, our Ukiah sawmill produces 55 million feet of lumber a year, mostly redwood. But we have a distribution business that sells almost 400 million feet of lumber a year. So 55 million feet coming out of the mill, but we're distributing, selling to a lot of it to Home Depot, but also a lot of it to other independent lumber yards and distributors, another 345 million feet of lumber. We think that's been a very successful strategy, and we think one of the ways we make the Scotia Mill successful for the long term is we take the what we estimate to be 100 million feet of lumber coming out of the Scotia Mill under our plan, and we add it on to the distribution business that we already have, and we give the benefits of that back to the new company that's being formed here. And that is a big piece of our plan. If you look at our financials there at the back of the disclosure statement, you would see that almost half of the profits that we think that we could make under our plan on an annual basis come from being able to successfully operate the sawmill and the related distribution activities. And that plan was built up with a tremendous effort from our management team. People basically worked the whole month of January to put all that together in a way that we have a lot of confidence. The benefits that we're bringing to the new company is there are some synergies that happen. We can eliminate duplicative senior management. So we have an existing senior management team that we've worked together, some of us for almost a full 10 years, some for 8, I think one guy maybe 4 or 5. But we're going to bring that existing team to the operation of what's elegantly called NewCo here. I feel funny with that name. We're gonna consolidate some information systems. We think that we can eliminate some duplicative sales and so on. The two big items on this slide is eliminate duplicative senior management, and in particular, utilize existing distribution facilities, capabilities, and relationships. This is really the $10 million of synergies we talked about in the beginning, and of the $10 million here, $6 million of it is this last point, and the others kind of all are a piece of it after that. Okay, this is a chart that we're not going to read line by line. I want to first just say this chart exists starting on page 2 of the disclosure statement. It's a summary of the 5 competing plans of reorganization that are in front of the court. And it has a whole bunch of different provisions that are in it. I'm just going to read 2 that are here, but again, as I talked about in the beginning, any creditor who's here or anybody who wants to really understand what's going on should read the disclosure statement in its entirety. There's 5 plans in front of the court. The first is the MRC Marathon plan. The second is a plan from what's called the indenture trustee. The indenture trustee represents the $800 million of bonds that are owed their money based on what the timberlands are worth. The third plan is a plan called the debtor's plan. The debtor's plan is a plan that's been put forth by Palco and Scotia Pacific together. Fourth plan is the Palco alternative plan, and the fifth plan is the Scotia alternative plan. This gets a little confusing, but in essence, the debtors put forth one plan called the debtor's plan that was a plan that deals with Palco and Scotia Pacific together. And then they said, court, if for some reason the debtor's plan, for whatever reason, doesn't work, we want you to consider 2 alternative plans, a Palco-only plan and a Scopac-only plan. And the one column I want, because we called this meeting with an eye towards talking to unsecured creditors, I want to point out that in the table here, it talks about how unsecured creditors get treated under each of the 5 plans. So in the MRC Marathon plan, there's $10.6 million of cash that's set aside for the unsecured creditors of Palco and Scotia Pacific. It's actually $10.1 million for Palco and $500,000 for Scotia Pacific. And as we talked about, the disclosure statement estimates that the known claims for those 2 entities are the same as the cash we've put up, but there are still the possibility of additional claims coming from litigation and contracts that are broken through the bankruptcy process that result in additional liability. In addition to the $10.6 million that's put up, there's also a litigation trust that's been established for the benefit of the unsecured creditors as well. That will be funded with $500,000 to pursue litigation where Palco or Scotia Pacific is a beneficiary. With the exception that that litigation trust does not include the litigation that the company has filed against the state of California for breach of the headwaters agreement. And that's a summary of how the unsecured creditors get treated under the MRC Marathon plan. The indentured trustee plan, this is a plan that's put forth on behalf of the bondholders. The indentured trustee is a representative of the bondholders. Has $1.45 million of cash set aside for unsecured claims of Scotia Pacific. And the disclosure statement estimates the claims of Scotia Pacific at $500,000. So that's providing more cash than what is identified as the unsecured claims there. The indentured trustee plan, however, is a plan that is only for Scotia Pacific. It makes no provisions and does not otherwise address Palco. So Palco is left to sort things out on its own under the indentured trustee plan. And we can talk more about that. The debtor's plan provides that the unsecured creditors would get 100% of what they're owed in the form of a note or an IOU or what have you that would pay interest at 8.25% for 7 years, and then people would get their principal back after the seventh year. The Palco alternative plan is a very similar treatment to the joint debtors plan, the debtors plan. The SCOPAC alternative plan pays the unsecured creditors of SCOPAC in full when the bankruptcy gets resolved. So those are the slides I wanted to walk through with people. We could talk a lot more, but rather than us deciding what we should talk about, we really wanted to have covered what we thought were the basics and then let people ask questions or make comments or do whatever you all want to do. So I guess now I want to take a minute. Some of our gang is here. Gary Lembo is here from Marathon.
My apologies for being late, but as many of you probably know, flying up here. There are no guarantees.
Welcome to Humboldt County.
Yeah. Finding that out the hard way.
And let's see, Richard, you want to come out and Marty? Richard Higginbottom. Richard, I already told all the crowd all about you, so you won't get to hear what I said.
That's safe.
Richard joined us. Richard succeeded me running our business day to day 8 years ago. The business was far better served when he became in charge. And Marty Olheiser also has been with us since day one when we started. Now, Marty and I met more than 10 years ago, and he's done a whole bunch of things for us over time, serves in a senior role of the company. With that, I think before we do questions, I want to. We have with us Steve Will. Steve, where are you? Okay, Steve told me I wanted to think of a joke that I could tell all of you before we started the session today. I couldn't think of one other than a lot of you probably have kids, and it's days like today that you should be thinking, I should make my kid go to public speaking class because big group of people, it's good to practice. Steve is a member of the official committee for the unsecured creditors of all of the various debtors. And the unsecured creditors committee has on their own come to a recommendation for all the unsecured creditors, and Steve can address that. Do you want to come down here, Steve, and do that? No, we can.
I'll be all right.
We can.
Good morning. I'm not a very good speaker either, so bear with me. I've been on the unsecured creditors committee when the company first filed bankruptcy. I've never been involved in nothing like this, and there were some things that happened that I felt that I needed to be on it to represent the community, because there was not enough representatives that I felt from the community that was going to be on the unsecured credit committee to help us in this community. So who is on the is Epic, the Steelworkers, a fellow by the name of Steve Cave, who is up in Freshwater with lawsuits against the company for Fresh and Elk River and them things. There's also Miles Crail, who has delivered hog fuel and stuff to the company that's on it. He's the chairman. There's myself. There's Jeff Nelson from SHN in Eureka. And then there's a company called the PVGC, who is on there because of the pension plan. And at the time I went down to the meeting in San Francisco, there was none of us on it except for Epic and Steelworkers, and I thought it was pretty lopsided to the wrong side. So eventually I got on it. We spent a lot of time on this, the committee. We've been in Texas to the mediation. Me and Miles, ourselves, were there. It took a lot of time and effort to get to the point we're in right now. We as the committee voted for the MRC plan and against the indentured trustees and the debtors plan, three of them. Part of why Sandy has talked to you about, they're coming up with real money. The $10.6 million to the unsecured to be distributed out. The things that I liked about it were it was going to combine the company back to one. The timberlands and the mill would be run together. And the other thing I liked, for being in business, if you owe people a lot of money, it's difficult to make it in business. And the new company is going to put up a lot of money of their own money to get started to reduce the debt on it. And I thought that was really important for the future of this community and our kids and grandkids and everybody else. They're going to keep the mill here. They're going to run the sawmill. The other plans, we really don't know. And so I wanted to, that was one of the important things for us. And then the other real important thing for me was that the pension plan that they're going to assume, that's pretty big. There's a lot of retirees. The PVGC is involved in that. It's real complicated. But for them to step up in Mendocino and say that they were going to take care of the retirees was pretty big for me. Knowing a lot of people in the community, I've lived here a long time, was born here. So I thought that was pretty good. Guys have given their life for the company, that it was going to be taken care of. If I'm running too long, you guys can say something. A lot of what I'm saying is in the same paperwork that Sandy's talking about, so if you need to, you can read it in that. It was also going to change the control of the company out of Maxam's hands, and we all lived here for the last 22 years, and Pacific Lumber Company is a great company. It's been a great company. And it needs to be brought back to that. I think it's good for all of us that live in this community day to day that somebody that's back in family-owned company, that's going to be good for us. That is why I voted that we vote for the MRC and Mendocino and a Marathon plan. The indentured trustee plan only worries about SCOPAC. Doesn't worry about the mill, the people in the mill, or any of that stuff, and that's why we as the committee, or me, pushed for that plan is not going to do this community any good. There's plans coming around, but it's still not as good a plan as you can see. The Mendocino Marathon plan, they've done their homework. They're showing you what they're doing. Other plans that are coming around, they can't tell us anything yet. There's other things I'm invited to. It still can't tell us where we're going. And here it is, March, year, 2 months later, and this is a plan. And the other plans are going to have somebody on this and somebody on that, and I just like the Mendocino plan. We disagreed with the indentured trustee's estimate that the SCOPAC rent secures were going to get 100% of their money. We don't think that, that'll be the case. And
you want to say why that is, Steve?
Well, yeah, they for one, they're not going to take care of the retirees, the pension plan. There's a huge amount of money owed to the pension plan. I mean, a lot of money. And nobody can tell you for sure, but it's between $20 and $25 million. And nobody's willing to step up. MRC Marathon has, and that to me was a good plan for us.
I would just say, as it has been described to me, the indenture trustee plan does not contribute to the unfunded pension liability that exists at Palco. I think the indenture trustee thinks that that is not a liability, that they've dealt with that liability in a different fashion. The unsecured creditor committee, I think, is worried that if the indenture trustee plan happened, that somehow in the court process that the pension liability could dilute what the unsecured creditors could recover. Nobody knows, but the unsecured creditor committee is saying that it's their opinion that that could be a problem.
Right. If what that, I don't know if that, Sandy explained it. If that money will get put into the unsecured, that $20 million will eat up anything that us mom and pops are owed. And that's pretty pretty big for all us small people here that, you know, are owed money. And then the debtor's plan, it would take 7 years to get money. There was no money injected, you know, for the company. It was, you know, to borrow to sell property. It just doesn't look like that'll work. It's going to take years down the road for all that to come out. And like I said, for me, this plan, MRC and Marathon, puts money into the company and keeps it running right now. And in a very, very tough lumber market that we're all facing, the housing market. So it's a plan that I think keeps the company running, and that's why I voted for it and think it's good for this community. If anybody's got questions.
Hey, as a committee, did you vote abstain or approve?
I'm sorry.
Did you vote alone on the plan, or did the whole committee vote?
Each seven of us all casted our vote.
Was it unanimous?
Pretty close.
Is there something I could ask a quick question too? Because I'm not sure. I don't want to get myself into
it. Yeah, so we've been invited
in trouble here.
We should describe things in a fashion consistent with the disclosure statement.
I think I'll leave it at that.
I don't know. I just want to add to what Steve said, that the letter from the unsecured creditor committee is very specific. It was something that was approved by the court. It describes the official position of the unsecured creditor committee, and it's available in the disclosure statement as Exhibit AA. So it's kind of halfway through. It should be listed in the table of contents. Exhibit AA has the version, the final version of the unsecured creditors committee letter. It's also available on the MRC website at the top of the filings of the joint disclosure statement in its own document. So we're going to take questions. Mike and I just mentioned that I should explain how it is that we have a videotape here and so on. And it probably is not a surprise to most of you to know that the bankruptcy process is a contentious litigation. And there's lots of lawyers from all over the country working on this and so on. And we were told that we should be sure to have a record of what we said to everybody here so that we would be able to be clear that we, that the things that we described to all of you was consistent with what's in the disclosure statement, and that we didn't promise anything that hadn't previously been talked about in the disclosure statement. And that's why that's going on. Okay, with that, questions? Yeah.
With your $8 million, almost $8 million investment in the mill, can you reduce prices? Are you confident you'll be able to run the mill all your own?
That's a great question. So the business plan that we put forth contemplates that the mill will consume the 55 million feet of timber that we expect to harvest. And I think we think that's about one shift for most of, is that all the year, Richard? Can you comment?
So it's a real close balance. Fortunately, the 55 million board feet, 57 range, is a pretty good match to what we think that the consumption rate would be on one shift at the mill, providing you're going to run the Doug fir as well.
I was just going to ask that, considering your overrun factor and also putting, you guys must be glad I'm running Doug fir.
Yes, we are.
And certainly in MRC's business, we have for many years, from time to time, I think every year actually, we buy modest amounts of logs on the outside to balance things out. And we could imagine that a similar kind of thing could happen here. That would be different than what I know of the log purchases that began when the mill started. When the Scotia Mill opened, you know, there was a large amount of logs that needed to be bought on the outside, and I think that was a challenging thing. But at MRC, we've had modest log purchases on the outside, and I think that's worked well over time.
So one thing we do in our mill is we'll sometimes sell logs that are not necessarily a good fit for our mill from an efficiency standpoint. We'll replace that volume on the outside. Not exactly a trade, but we'll sell and buy some. And I'm going to apologize for being late. The log got us. Well, it would be a mixture of what comes off the lands. And so I think this is pretty clear in our disclosure statement. The intent here is that we're going to try to align what the lands provide to a market that values those products. And the mill will work in concert with the harvest and the consumption in the marketplace. Versus some strategies are you run a mill and as fast as you can, you produce the products that come out, you sell them at the best price you can get as they come out of the mill. And we tend to think the mill's job is to take that harvest and convert it to what consumers want to buy. And we have some good history doing this, of making certain that we're producing products that consumers want. We do a lot of market research so we understand what those products are and where they move and who buys them and how consumer preferences change so that we can align with that. In our own mill, for example, we're producing a lot more fencing than we ever have because that's what the market wants. And there's a real argument you can make mathematically that says, well, you know, fencing isn't the best product always to make to get the highest value. Yes, but consumers want it, they need it, they buy it, you make what the consumer wants.
And we run an operation that's flexible enough to change when those market conditions change.
Yeah, so that's an important point here on the mill. We made our decision several years ago to make certain our mill was flexible enough to be able to build a variety of products. So we can run multiple species and we can build a broad mix of products.
All right, next question. Yes.
I have a couple of questions. Obviously, when you go before the bankruptcy judge, you would like to have the most number of votes for your plan to show the judge that your plan is the best plan of what the people want. From an individual standpoint, does my vote, for example, count the same as Steve Will's vote, or are they weighted?
That's a great question.
So,
yeah.
His vote counts a lot more than mine.
So, at the beginning, I think I tried to say the unsecured creditors vote as a class, and every vote counts. And the votes are counted two ways. They're counted based on the number of creditors who vote and the dollar amount of the claim. So, on the number of creditors who vote, you and Steve have the same vote. On the dollars of claim, whoever has the biggest claim has that the dollar-weighted vote. But in order to carry a class, so MRC hopes that we will have the support of the unsecured creditors class. And in order to carry the class, we need a certain number of individuals or the businesses that vote, and we need a certain number of the dollars. And I don't remember those exact numbers, but they're both of them are more than half, and one's a little more than half than the other. So every creditor's vote matters.
I have another question. There's an unsecured debtors list, if you will. And if you were a retired person drawing a pension, if you didn't file separately to the bankruptcy court, that you had a claim, I don't think you showed up on the unsecured debtors list. And you talked about earlier about people voting, and you could go to this website,
yep,
and all that's all that. I'm making an assumption that there are a lot of people that are drawing a pension that didn't file to the bankruptcy court. So have you got a group of people that can't vote, or do you have a lot of people that could vote if they file on the internet, and the fact that there's a very short period of time to do that?
Yeah, so great question. The specifics of individual claims, does somebody have a claim or not, how much is the claim, is the claim valid, is all something that's being handled by the company. So if there are people who have claims and didn't file, that becomes something that has to be worked out between them and the existing PALCO manager. They should call and contact PALCO. Whether or not they can get a vote if they go file now, I don't know the answer to that. But if anybody is owed money by PALCO and they don't think they've registered themselves as a claim, but you know, they should be contacting the company. We tried to anticipate as many questions as we could. I don't know the answer as to whether or not people who draw a pension needed to file a claim or not. I just don't know that. So I probably haven't answered your question, but I've at least referred you back to the company, I guess.
Maybe a question for the trustee as well. If you call and make the trustee to see if they said.
Yeah.
The PBGC is representing on unsecured all the retirees.
So you think that they're covered?
I don't know.
So we don't know that. That would be a, if anybody has a question about whether or not, if somebody has a question as to whether or not they have a claim against the company, hasn't been registered, they should talk to the company and they should do that promptly. Another question? Yeah.
I was going to talk about what constitutes a confirmable plan. Can you comment if you think your plan is confirmable?
Yes. So the question is, what is a confirmable plan, and is our plan confirmable? So without being a lawyer, I'll describe what's been described to me. When plans are being talked about as being confirmable, it really is a question of, does the plan comply with the entire body of bankruptcy law in the final opinion of the judge? So there's bankruptcy law is a very substantial field, and there's a lot of requirements that are necessary to have a plan that is something that complies with all the law. If it does, and ultimately is determined by the bankruptcy judge in the court that this is being held in, then the plan is quote-unquote confirmable. Our lawyers, and we have a number of them, have worked very hard to help us prepare what they tell us is a confirmable plan. It is important for MRC's plan to be confirmed to have the support of the unsecured creditors. So we hope that unsecured creditors, if they read the whole disclosure statement and weigh the various plans, will vote for our plan. Does that answer the question?
We have, on the unsecured creditor committee, there's two attorneys hired. So for us to vote that way, it looks pretty confirmable.
That ultimately, whether or not the MRC plan will be confirmed or not, will be determined by the judge.
When?
Excellent question. So the schedule as it exists today is that unsecured creditors have until March 25th to vote. That means your vote must be in the hands of the balloting agent, Logan & Company, on March 25th. It doesn't mean postmarked. It means in their hands, March 25th. And the ballot must be fully completed, as we talked about earlier. Then, assuming that all the parties don't somehow get in a room and agree to something consensually, and based on the 13 or 14 months of bankruptcy that's gone on, it would seem like that may not be very likely, the judge in the bankruptcy court in Texas is going to hold a confirmation trial starting on April 8th. I think nobody has been able to tell me how short or long that will last. It's expected to last at least several days. It would not surprise me if it lasted longer because there's a tremendous number of experts and people are going to come testify and so on. But I think at the conclusion of that trial, The judge will decide, is there one confirmable plan, multiple confirmable plans, or no confirmable plans? And if there's one confirmable plan, it would seem like it would be likely that that would move ahead. If there's multiple confirmable plans, it's been described to me by lawyers that the judge then has to weigh what plan is the best plan. If there's no confirmable plans, I think the judge has other options that he can pursue then. But my sense is that I'm sure many people, we've watched the bankruptcy very closely from when it began. It's gone on for a long time. At times it seems like there's very little progress. The lawyers that have advised me have been describing that the process is, you know, getting towards the end here. But that's the best we can say for when. Yeah. Two things. One was a comment on Maxim and Charles Hurwitz. That wasn't really a question, was it?
Well, I think that's part of why this situation is happening. I mean, if you let somebody who's a corporate criminal get away with it and then let them take over a company, they're going to drive into bankruptcy. That's kind of how they operate.
Right. So, and I think with respect to that, all we can really do is say, gosh, we would want you to judge us based on what we've done at MRC and what we've talked about, what we hope to do here. With regard to your second question, so we're definitely aware of people who are interested in the community-based forestry. You know, our plan is really focused on trying to come up with a combination of forest management plans, sawmill, and distribution strategy that would allow the company going forward to have a high probability of success in our best estimate. And over time, we'll probably consider lots of things that we might do, but our initial plans are really focused on changing the forest practices, seeking FSC certification, fixing the Scotia sawmill and positioning it for long-term success, and implementing the distribution strategy for lumber that we've described so that this company can get on can get into a mode of operation where things are predictable, where the employment is stable, where the product is well accepted by the customers, and the customers know the product will be available on a dependable basis. And, we get all that done, then we can think about what we do after that. Yes?
If you guys take over, how long do you get? I mean, are you going to shut everything down and reorganize and then everybody goes back to work? I mean, is the mill going to shut down? The volume going to shut down?
Yeah, that's a great question. I know how important that question is to anybody who works at the company or works for a supplier to the company. And, our goal would be to minimize as much as possible the inefficiencies of a transition. We just don't know how, if we were to be successful in court, we just don't know how that transition will get managed yet. And that really is going to depend on how the court would rule, whether or not people object to what the court rules. We want to minimize that. We do talk about in the disclosure statement that the capital project that we envision for the mill will require the mill to be down some. And although this is something that has not been fully worked out, the disclosure statement talks about that we at least would want to try to for a time while the mill was down, we would want to try to run a second shift in Ukiah and offer the positions to man that on a first come basis to Palco mill workers. The logging could continue during that time, and we think it's important for Redwood product to keep product getting to the store shelf. So we both for the people issues and for the product issues, we would work to minimize all this, but we just don't have all the answers to that yet. Yes.
Will the employees be terminated and rehired, and will they, or if an RC takes it, will they assume their current seniority and so forth?
Yeah. So this is another transition issue that we need more information from the court and the company to be able to figure out. It's I can say this about employment, which is that the level of activity that we envision for the new company, if it was being done at MRC, would require 250 employees, plus or minus. So, we can kind of ballpark the number of employees that we think are required for success here. The town will have some employees, and the cogen plant will have employees too. Those are separate and apart from the business plan we've talked about with the forest and the mill. But how the transition works from today to where that would be is, again, something we need more information to figure out. As soon as we know that, we will share that. But we need more information to be able to sort that through. Yes?
Is MRC going to manage the power plant?
The plan currently is that Marathon is going to, in some way, oversee somebody who will manage the power plant. That's something that we'll just have to. We know that. Yeah. Hey, we know that the best thing is for the plant to run. Although we won't be managing the plant, we're gonna. We have more people on the ground. We're gonna do what we can to be helpful to Marathon there. We'll do the best that can be done. We just don't have the answer to that yet. The capital project for the mill will require a certain amount of time to engineer. We don't have access to the mill to be engineering that today, right? So, the day the judge says, okay, everything's done, it's yours, go, if that day happens, there'll be a month or two where we'll be very busily trying to finalize the capital projects for the mill. There may be some time to plan for what to do with the sawmill, to what to do with the cogen plant for the time when the mill's down.
Sandy's point, we don't have access to a lot of information at the company right now. So when if the plan gets approved, then we do have all the access. There's a lot of analysis we have to do, and we look to fully understand that. We're in this together, MRC and Marathon. So we're gonna work pretty close together. We've been working very close together. So we know how important it is for town and mill project plans. So.
And to the extent that we can. Out of our existing operations, we'll try to make things as seamless as possible. So we do have the similar operations that Sandy identified. We'll work together the best we can to minimize the impact on employees.
But we have a lot of we understand how important this is to all the folks who work here. We also know as a business that taking things up and down is very disruptive. So we're going to do our level best on all of this. But I'd be kidding you if I didn't tell you that there's going to be, some challenges to get through. And, what our goal is to do the best we can to minimize the challenges of getting from where we are to, if we're successful, to what a reorganized company would be, but to set the company up for long-term success. Yes?
Will the amount of land that is currently set aside for timber production remain approximately the same, or would that be reallocated to conservation?
Approximately the same. So at MRC, in 10 years, we think we've done some great things on the land, and I talked about various measurable ecological progress that we look to. But in 10 years, of the 230,000 acres we started with, we've sold, in one transaction, 3,500 acres. We did that because it was an isolated parcel in Sonoma County. It was an hour from the Golden Gate Bridge. It had value that was much, it was a piece of property that the timber value was a small piece of the value of the property. And we had been approached by the Sonoma County Open Space District, and they really wanted to add it to a park. We weren't looking to sell it, but we thought, you know, this would be a chance for us to learn what is it like to do one of these. And one of the things we learned from that is, boy, it takes a lot of time. And we're really thinking of ourselves and have operated and acted as a timber business. And so, you know, we mostly want to keep the land as a single block for commercial forestry over the long term. Yes. So this is my first time doing something like this in a bankruptcy court. The lawyers tell me that anything can happen. You know, so hey, anybody can make a proposal and what have you, and go in front of the judge and so on. But the 13 or 14 months of the bankruptcy case, the events of that, in my mind, suggests that probably what's going to happen is these things are going to go in front of the judge and he's going to decide what plans are confirmable. And that might be the kind of catalyst that might then lead to, I just don't know. Our sense is it's going to go in front of the judge and he's going to have to decide what plans work. Was there another? Yes.
Once the judge makes a decision on what plan to go forward with, the MRC plan, whatever, where does all the litigation stand? The lawsuits against the different divisions and stuff against Papo, are those decisions being made also along with what plan that they, or is there going to be continuing litigation and lawsuits going on after the judge affirms the plan for the company?
So, you know, we're without a bankruptcy lawyer here today, and we didn't know whether to bring somebody or not. That's the kind of question I wish I had a bankruptcy lawyer to help answer. This may be addressed in the disclosure statement, and if it is, whatever it says would be the definitive on this. My best guess with that qualifier is that in some way, as the bankruptcy process is being completed, that the judge is going to estimate outstanding litigation, and that would then, to the extent that the plaintiffs wanted to pursue it, they'll run through their trial, see if they can kind of perfect their claim. And
it's not something to say MRC is going to take on.
Litigation against the company, I think, kind of gets cleaned up in the bankruptcy process, but I just don't know the mechanics of that. And so you have to look at the disclosure statement or call a lawyer. There are all these lawyers you can call. I don't know if they'll talk to you or not, but I think they will. And litigation that the company has against other people, so litigation with a company where Palco could benefit. There's a litigation trust that's been created under our plan. Under our plan, there's a litigation trust that's been funded with $500,000 for the company to pursue litigation where it can benefit and to give the benefit of that to the unsecured creditors, with the exception of the Headwaters litigation, which we have separated out to be an asset of the new company.
You call Winston Strong, my lawyer, Billy Crescentis. Give him a call, he's in there.
Yeah.
He'll answer the question.
Yeah, a lawyer would know the answer to that question.
Yeah.
Other questions? Yes.
Your certification program on your SFI, does it include hiring contractors that are certified to do the work?
So, question is, SFI certification, does it include hiring contractors? So, a couple things. First, MRC is FSC certified as opposed to SFI certified. The differences on that are we could have a whole meeting to talk about that because it gets complicated. But we would intend to pursue FSC certification, and FSC certification does not require specific certification of the contractors in the woods. What it requires is that the contractors perform to the standards that are expected through the certification process. Does that answer the question? Great.
Certification of blockers would be a benefit
in the FLC system. They just don't require it. We would use it as a screening process, most certainly.
Great. Was there a question in the back?
The $10 million money you had set aside, does that include service packages that they were offered in last year?
So this is a question that we that at least was brought to our attention in thinking about this, and the answer is the specifics of individual claims are things that really the company is the keeper of the knowledge on. So if you got a ballot that says you can vote, that says somebody thinks you have a claim. Now, how much the claim is and so on, I just don't know. But any questions about how much or the validity of a specific claim, you have to go to the company on. You have to go to Palco on.
Well, I understand that, but I mean, that generally you had set aside to pay claims. Is this part of it?
All we really know about the $10 million of claims is that the company has provided to the court, and the court has put into the disclosure statement that in aggregate there are $10.6 million of known unsecured claims, plus anything that comes out of contracts that are broken or litigation that harms the company. So if the company included it in that, then it is part of it. If they didn't, it isn't. I just don't have the answer to that. Yes.
You stated earlier that part of your agenda was not to be clear cutting lands.
Yep.
We have several plans that are in the system and approved that have clear cut proposed. Would you amend those?
So our intent on plans that are in the system is, to the maximum extent we can, to modify them to what would be an MRC plan, the kind of plan that we use at MRC. And I think that our proposal here is to convert those to variable retention if they're not well-stocked stands, Mike?
Correct.
So at MRC, we in lieu of traditional clear-cutting, where we have acres that, in particular, would have a fair amount of hardwood, a fair amount of tan oak, we use variable retention in an effort to try and position the stand to return to being a robust conifer forest. For well-stocked conifer stands, we rely largely on selection harvesting. So if there are clear-cutting plans in stands that are, you know, have a fair amount of hardwood, well, those would be easy to convert to retention. If it's a stand that was well-stocked conifer, what would we do with that?
We would do an assessment of the stand, take a good look at the whitewood component in the stand, and then make a decision about how intensive we were going to do a selection cutting in the stand. And in certain cases, if it was a stand that was pretty old, had a lot of definite whitewood in it, we might opt to do a variable retention in a stand like that, because you look at that in terms of the need to restart the stand. You look at it the same way as you do hardwood.
Sandy, in the disclosure statement, we have an estimate of harvest for the first the first year. This is a rough estimate that's in there, and that was done with the understanding that we would modify these plans.
That we
would. We looked at the best of the knowledge was available. We looked at the plans that had been filed and went through those to determine could they be modified, what level they'd be modified away from clear cuts, where traditional clear cuts. And we came up with that harvest rate. So we have looked at those plans and have investigated possibly the potential and process to get them modified.
So I would just add an answer. The goal would be to modify the plans to get them to be to what would be an MRC standard, the maximum extent we can, but also to make sure that we do allow harvesting to continue, because it really affects the mill and affects all the people working in the woods. And we think both those things can be done.
Yeah, I have one more question. What do you consider a roll growth? What's your definition of roll growth? There's a lot of them out there. We have a lot of trees that really don't meet old growth, but they're tight grained the first half of the tree, and then as the stand was released, you get wider grain. What's your definition of
roll growth? Hello, we're trees.
So this is something that we really worked on a lot in our first 2 years in business, because we knew when we started in business that we wanted to say what old growth existed on the lands we were buying. Of course, then the question became, well, what is old growth? And to some people, old growth could be any tree that you want to save. We were looking for how can we come up with a biologically or ecologically based definition of old growth, and also be certain that it was something that could be honored in the field, right? An old growth policy only works if you're sure that you comply with it, and you got to make sure that you know how to comply with it before the tree is on the ground. So just counting the rings doesn't work. And the way we approach that is we came up with a multi-pronged test.